This year marks the 50th anniversary of the laser, an object of science that has long captivated the minds of science fiction writers, military strategists, and the public alike. Did you know that Albert Einstein was one of the scientists who worked on the more theoretical side of the laser? Or that the word laser itself is an acronym, short for Light Amplification by Stimulated Emission of Radiation? In 50 years, lasers have come a long way, from the first masers, the original precursor to light amplified radiation, to the eventual practical use of lasers in supermarket checkout counters, home entertainment systems, and surveyors' tools. This is the History Explorer Meet Our Museum podcast, and in this month's episode, we speak with Hal Wallace, curator of the electricity collections here at the Museum of American History, to discuss the development of the laser and what it's meant to American culture and history.
I'm Hal Wallace, and I'm the curator of the electricity collections here at the National Museum of American History, and I'm the curator of the exhibition 50 Years of Lasers. We're currently in the anniversary year of not one, but three different kinds of lasers.
So Hal, can you talk about the development of the laser, and perhaps when was the first laser developed and what was it used for?
Okay. The laser experiments come out of World War II and materials research set up during the war. The groundwork was laid beginning early in the 20th century with Albert Einstein thinking about stimulated emission, the scientific properties by which atoms and molecules can emit radiation. This stayed in a highly, refined scientific sense for many decades. Coming out of the war, a physicist at Columbia University, Charles Townes, had been looking at microwaves, and specifically microwave spectroscopy and microwave communications during the war, radar systems, which work on microwaves. And after the war, began thinking about other ways you might use microwaves, supported by funding from the U.S. Navy and primarily, but other sources as well, developed an amplifier based on Einstein's theories and prior experiments done by Nicholas Blomberg and others. Townes developed this amplifier for microwaves using stimulated emission of radiation. Microwave amplification by stimulated emission of radiation, or MASER.
Okay.
This was in 1954. Masers were reasonably easy to do compared to later lasers because the energy level for microwaves is lower. Lower energy level microwaves, which got people interested in the physics and showed that stimulated emission could be done. The maser ultimately didn't find much application. However, everyone began to realize if you could bump the energy levels up, get shorter wavelengths of radiation, you could begin to get into light. And once you could get into light, a lot of other applications could come forth.
So the maser didn't emit any light?
No, it emitted microwaves.
Okay.
Now, the microwaves acted in the same manner that light acts in a laser. Mm-hmm. The beam is highly focused, doesn't spread out, but it's at the microwave wavelength, so the wavelengths are a bit longer than they are with light.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, Townes and his brother-in-law, Art Shallow, at Bell Labs, began experimenting with shorter wavelengths. And in 1959, hosted a conference called Quantum Electronics. And they brought in scientists from all over the country who were working in this area. And by this time, people were beginning to work on what they called an optical maser, a maser that would work at optical wavelengths.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some people wanted to use ruby crystals for masers and had done so. And there were several papers presented why a ruby crystal really wouldn't work well in generating light. Well, one of the attendees of the conference was Theodore Maiman of Hughes Aircraft. And he had done some work with ruby maser crystals. And he just didn't quite get what he was hearing. Something didn't sound right. So he went back to his lab at Hughes after the conference and began experimenting with rubies in different ways. And in May 1960, he and Ernie DeHaines, his assistant, demonstrated the first working laser, a small crystal of ruby, small cylindrical crystal of ruby, set inside a spiral photographer's flash lamp, mm-hmm. and all mounted in a little metal housing. We may have the first crystal and the first housing on display here in the showcase. There's some question about, you know, do we actually have the first?
I'm sure there's always that question whenever an exhibit is being put together.
Exactly. Yeah. But this may be the first laser and the first laser crystal. Maiman published his experiments, published the results of his work, and others began replicating his work. You'll see on display from 1963 a ruby laser from Ohio State University, where the researchers there were building on what Maiman had done just to see, you know, replicate the experiment, mm-hmm. which is one of the ways science works, and to play with the parameters a little bit and see what effects they could get. At Bell Labs, the Iranian immigrant Ali Javan, who had studied with Towns at Columbia and taken his PhD under Towns, started thinking about gas lasers. And he came up with a helium neon laser that produced a continuous beam of light. This is quite important. And just a few feet away from Ali Javan's laser, you'll see one of the first supermarket scanners that actually uses a helium neon laser. So 14 years after Ali Javan demonstrates the helium neon laser, you have the introduction of supermarket scanners that utilize this technology.
So the process has so far has been this theoretical idea of amplified mm-hmm. emissions, and then the maser, and then soon after that was the laser, which is the optical version or somewhat of the maser, if I can kind of you know, summarize a little bit. And then you've got, a few years later, a continuous light, and then we're mm-hmm. already in a practical use of it in the grocery store.
Right. Where in this case, a few months later, you go from a pulsed laser of Maiman's and Sorokin's, and you know, in December of 1960, Javan, you know, demonstrating his continuous mm-hmm. beam of light. Yeah, there's some questions scientifically. There's not a whole lot of difference between a maser and a laser. They just work at different wavelengths. There are technical differences, and it was more difficult to produce a laser mm-hmm. because it operates at a higher energy level. But the big difference are the applications. So many different applications, so many different things you can do with that higher energy level of light that you couldn't do with microwaves. One of the immediate thoughts on everyone's mind and attracted the military's interest especially was the idea of laser weapons.
Oh,
this,
yeah.
This idea of death rays or ray guns
yeah.
that gets picked up in science fiction beforehand in the works of H.G. Wells and others, and appears very soon on TV in Star Trek, for example, mm-hmm. with the phaser. So you even have the name being, you know, worked into the science fiction. But this idea, everyone could grasp this idea of a directed energy weapon is what we would call it today. And it's a fine idea if that's what you're after, and you can do it in the lab. And we have a 1985 target on display of six steel plates with a hole burned right through them, front to back, by a chemical laser at the U.S. Army's Redstone Arsenal. But it's difficult to do under battlefield conditions, and it's difficult to do in the real world. Actual way that laser weaponry developed was not like the fantasy. It's a fantasy reality situation. The fantasy is this ray gun that just blows up or disintegrates the target. The reality is soldiers today, Marines, will use a laser target designator to put a laser beam spot on a target, and a sensor on a shell or a bomb mm-hmm. missile will home in on that spot and destroy the target. So the laser is an indirect weapon, not a direct weapon. The other major military use for lasers right now is rangefinders. Laser rangefinders in American tanks make them exceptionally accurate on the battlefield. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the reasons in the 1991 Gulf War why our military just tore through the numerically very powerful Iraqi military.
Hmm. Yeah. So aside from the military, and you said that one of the first practical uses was in the grocery store, something that everyone has an experience with, what were some of the other first practical uses for lasers?
Lasers very quickly became used for leveling and surveying applications. This idea of accurately measuring distances with a laser beam took hold very quickly. We do have a laser level and laser light detector on display in the exhibition. That becomes one very early application. The laser scanner for the supermarket scanner required more than just the laser. The laser had been developed, but you also needed something for the laser to scan. Mm-hmm. So the development of barcoding, which was a history all of its own that required buy-in from many different manufacturers and organizations and companies, technical companies or technical organizations, as well as companies like IBM, for example, and National Cash Register and others, had to agree on the format of the barcoding, where it might be placed, how it would be read. Once all of these generally policy decisions were made, then that technology coupled with the laser and right. emerging computer technology to process the information could all be combined in an automated cash register system. Mm-hmm. So you have spectrophysics developing the scanner that you see on display and National Cash Register developing the computerized cash register that coupled to it to make the complete system.
It's interesting how, you know, something, history of science and something so technical can start to lead into really just the history of consumerism in this country and the way that people buy things and interact with our stores and things like that.
Indeed. We tend to make a differentiation between basic science and applied science. Basic science we tend to think of as knowledge for knowledge's sake, and applied science being something specifically designed for a particular right. project. In a sense, the differentiation, though, is arbitrary. Where does basic science stop and applied science begin? Many people argue there really is no difference. Science is science. And it's, as one Army person said, it's all in the eye of the beholder as to what's basic science and to what's applied science.
It's interesting. What do you think that lasers and the history of the development of lasers can teach students that they might not be learning about by reading a textbook?
Mm-hmm. Well, first, there's more than one way to invent something. History is not predetermined. There are many paths that can happen. History happens in one particular fashion for a variety of reasons, but there are many potential paths. So that's why you see in 1960 not one, but three different lasers being invented mm-hmm. within the span of 6 months. These were all the culmination of different research programs at different companies and universities, all paying off at about the same time. This idea of multiple developments, multiple paths to history, is definitely something to bear in mind. And for high school students as well, to question the source. Don't get locked up in this idea of the first. Because just looking at this showcase, for example, you know, when it comes to an object, do we have the first laser? We believe so. That's what Hughes Aircraft, the donor of the material, told us in 1970 when they donated the material. But the inventor, Theodore Maiman, said that he had the first laser and kept it when he left Hughes Aircraft not long after the invention. And so there were several of these things in the lab about the right time. We'll never really know, you know, which is the first laser. But in a sense, does it really matter?
Exactly.
We know the invention took place in that place at that time, and it's the results and the effects that really count. Also, that, you know, invention can come out of unusual places. No one expected Maiman to develop the first laser. No one expected Hughes Aircraft out on the West Coast, away from the East Coast mm-hmm. Ivy League research area, to actually succeed. And that took everyone by surprise to the point where Maiman's paper was initially rejected for publication because the editor of the journal thought it was just another Maser paper. And it turned out that it wasn't.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Hal, I've got to thank you for joining us today. I'm sure all of our listeners will find this really interesting and informative as well.
My pleasure.
That was Hal Wallace, tracing the development of the laser. To learn more about lasers and see some cool photos, visit the American Institute of Physics page on the subject found at www.aip.org/history/exhibits/laser. For the History Explorer Meet Our Museum podcast, this is Matt Ringelstetter. Tune in again next month to learn more about what goes on here at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Funding provided by the Verizon Thinkfinity Foundation. Music by Kynes Wider. To hear more, go to freemusicarchive.org.